I think there's a few things to look back at what was said today. Certainly, the personal experiences and the courage shown by all the individuals who got up to speak today is the hope part. That's the part where we know that we could live through this, struggle through this, so that we can change it. One of the things that I consider my most important teacher on struggle is Reverend James Lawson. And for a few years, Reverend James Lawson, we used to meet, a few of us, week after week in his church. And it was all with the purpose and the goal of connecting the dots, connecting our humanity and connecting our struggles. And that's one of the things that came to my mind today. I don't think that without a forum like the one that took place today, I don't think that anyone would have connected the dots between everyone who spoke today. I don't think anybody would have connected the dots between the youth who are struggling against the gang injunctions with the sister who just spoke about the dress that she wears and how she is insulted and intimidated on the street. I don't think that anybody would have connected the housing discrimination in those apartments owned by Donald Sterling to Harold Lugo and what took place at LAX with Operation Tarmac. I don't think any of these connections would have been made. And I think that is why those kinds of violations of our basic human rights continue to take place every day, because our struggles are not connected. And we have to put as a goal for ourselves to connect these struggles. The youth will not be successful in stopping the violations of their basic rights if they don't connect with the rest of us. And workers who are fighting for their rights to a decent job, to be treated with respect, are not going to win that if they don't connect with the kinds of human violations that are taking place when someone's civil liberties are denied. And I think that's a very important lesson that needs to be taken out there in a much bigger way and in a much more powerful way on a larger scale, because we are separated from each other and we have not joined together enough on these issues. I think the common denominator in terms of what is going on with us is the government. It's government action that is in cahoots with, I think, those who seek cheap labor, those who seek making the maximum profits. That's what is, I think, common here. A government that is violating our rights for the purposes of allowing big business, of allowing employers to get the most out of our work. And it's that old tactic of divide and conquer, and you get far more. And this nation, from the very beginning, has been filled with the divide and conquer tactics. It isn't 9/11 when all of this started. This has been going on from the very beginning, the birth of our nation. And we have to figure out ways to keep our struggles going instead of stopping when we think we've won something. And frankly, that's what happened. We had a whole generation or longer of people who stopped, as a nation, who stopped struggling for the civil rights of all people. We thought we had won it all, and that's not true. We didn't win it all. When the African American civil rights movement in this nation struggled for hundreds of years to deal with the racism that they were facing, they were courageous enough. They risked their lives for us. They opened the doors and they made civil rights a universal truth that applied to everybody. And it is our responsibility to keep that going. It is our responsibility to apply that to everybody. But we all have to do it together. And that is why I'm very proud to be a part of the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride. Because what it says to our nation is that while civil rights were won in this country and the doors were open to every nationality, after in the 60s, you know, there were anti-discrimination laws in housing. There were doors were open for women. I mean, there were also immigration laws. The nationality-based immigration quotas were eliminated. We have to continue that struggle. And what we intend to do with the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride is a national mobilization to say that we are all connected. 800 to 900 people will be in buses leaving 10 cities across this country. They will be going to and be received by 100 and plus cities. And those cities, there are coalitions. Coalitions between the NAACP and the AFL-CIO and on and on and on who will receive them until we get to Congress in Washington, D.C., and we go and visit those congressional people and say, look at all of us. We may look different, but we want the same thing. We want respect. We want our civil liberties, and we're going to fight for it, and we're going to get rid of some of you if you don't respect those rights. So I know I stop, but I want us another opportunity to connect us. On September 20th at Los Angeles City Hall at 10 a.m. is going to be the send-off rally for 140 new Freedom Riders who are going to travel across the country, and we hope you're there to wish them a good trip and a good struggle. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Marielena. We have next... as our next key witness, Imam Sadiq Safir. And let me just say a little bit about him. He is the co-founder of the Islamic Shura Council of Southern California that represents 50 masajid in Southern California. He's director and co-founder of the ILM Foundation, and he's authored numerous books and articles, including Ramadan, a Commentary, and a commentary on the 1992 Rodney King riots in L.A. entitled K-Day, the Day That Changed Los Angeles. With that, I'd like to welcome the Imam.
Let me begin with the name of God, and I'm going to extend to all of you the salutation of God's peace be unto you. I really want to compliment this organization on such an excellent, eye-opening venue but program. And I want to say, as I was listening, I think I really can actually not just sympathy, but also I can actually feel and actually have seen and experienced everything that was being heard. The blatant violation, and also when you think in terms of denial of human rights and denial of civil rights, as it was so excellently said, it really began when you think in terms of the childhood of America. And I think that we all somewhat understand that history, but I don't think we understand that this, what we're seeing today, is nothing new. And I think in terms of myself, and I can share this with you, and thinking in terms of 9-1-1, I think in terms of 9-1-1 was not only a time that redefined life as we knew it, and I think it also was a time when really I think it shocked people into a type of consciousness. I think in terms, when we think in terms of how we had to deal with it, and I know the only thing I could call on was really my religion. I had to really go and see what was the divine will of God. I was really concerned because I was also experiencing something for the first time. I had been used to being actually profiled, and I had been used to always being scrutinized. I have always been used to being guilty before actually proven guilty because of just being an African American. But at the same time, for the first time now, I had a double whammy on me. Here I am, a Muslim and an African American. And for the first time, I had to think in terms of the reality of what was taking place. Because I knew when I seen someone, a black and white behind me, I always knew when they were behind me, I was always terrorized from being African American. But here I am now having on Muslim clothes and maybe a kufi. That's a double whammy. And I think in terms of how I had to search God, I had to search for religion. I wanted to find what was the divine will of God. Interesting thing to me is when I looked at really this from an Islamic perspective, because as being a Muslim, I have to always make sure that the guidance of God is the most important guidance to me. And what I was reminded, the first thing, is that all life is sacred. All life is sacred. And I also reflected, especially on this important time, that through the will of God, that the will of God was that all loss of innocent life should be condemned. That the hatred and violence and extreme of any member identifying with any religion should never be justified as the fruits of religious conviction. And that it is a responsibility of all of those of the religion, but all of those of the society, to make sure that they work together until justice is done, until those is brought before justice. And I also reflected on the important thing of this reminding me for the first time, because what had happened to me as a Muslim, I think we had to really open our doors and we had to look outward. The Christians had to open their doors and they had to look outward. Jews had to open their doors and they always looked outward. We had to get over this disposition that because I am Islamically, I am the most right way of worship. Because I am Islamically, I am better in my worship than anybody else. And the Christian had to get over that, and the Jew had to get over it, because we were all vulnerable. We all realize now that in this global family, no one was really in a situation to where they can think in terms of it couldn't happen to them. And I reminded myself from a religious perspective, the solution to all of this is that when I had to think in terms of the divine will of God, reminding us that all of us, and look at yourself around your table, that all of us, if we simply understood that we all traced our ancestry back, everyone in here, it would take us back to common parents, Adam and Eve, that we would have no right to be divided because we have put barriers between us as human beings and created a type of artificial humanity where ethnocentrism really was more important to people than actually being of the human family. And as I think in terms of what happened, I think in terms of what happened today, we have to think in terms of ourselves as one thing. We have to think in terms of ourselves as we the people. As I listen to us talk sometime, I think you remind me of African Americans, how we always talk. We talk as if we are outside of America. You are America, whether you understand it or not. You are America. The government in America is the government that you entrusted and you put in there. And when you think in terms of our responsibility now, it is our collective responsibility. When we see justice being taken away from us, when we see the democracy of this Constitution being denied us, it is our responsibility to collectively come together and remind those who are entrusted and responsible that we demand that we honor the Constitution, that we honor the Constitution. We also demand the inalienable rights that was bestowed upon us by our Creator. And it's our important thing for us to understand as we come together in this room, we have to actually transcend just dispensation. We have to be able to implement the importance of coming together as one humanity. And when you think in terms of what is happening right before our eyes, we're living in a global world. This is a global family. Whether we know it or not, we have to ask ourselves, who's calling the shots in this government? Is this a democracy or is it a plutocracy? Is it a government of the people, for the people, of the wealthy, for the wealthy, denying the rights of the poor? So I compliment this here gathering here. I think it's important for us to understand that we have to remove the barriers between us as ethnicity. We have to remove the barriers between us as religion. We have to compete with our excellence to always uphold the divine right of every human being. Every human being can carry the divine spark of God. Every human being is dignified because of that. And it's our responsibility to make sure that we understand that we are collectively held to establish a prevailing justice for all people. And we have to make sure that we are each other's welfare. And only when we come together like we are in this room and understand it is we the people, and it's always been we the people. African Americans did not establish civil rights. It was we the people. If it wasn't for the people of the slaves, the children of slaves, and the children of slave masters, coming together, standing together, demanding justice, We would not have the civil rights movement like we had it. So we have to understand that there's always been we the people. And no matter what we call ourselves, we have to understand that's incidental. The most important thing, we are one humanity under one God. Peace be unto you.
So much. We are at a moment now where we have heard the key witnesses speak, and I want to remind all of you, as you were reminded, about our responsibility truly as the as part of this country, that we have responsibility today, having heard what we heard, to take it forward. And I think that's probably the most important thing we would like you to take away from this event. Before we part, we have a few more short speakers. We wanted to introduce to you someone who will inspire us even more to take action, to take the spirit of this event forward. And that person is Mr. Hamid Khan, the executive director of the South Asian Network. You didn't know you were going to do this, Hamid?
Thank you very much. It's kind of a tough one to follow after the imam and the call to action that he gave out. A lot has been said today, but I think before I say a few words and share some thoughts, I think the organizers really deserve much thanks and for all their efforts. And as co-sponsors of this event, it's really been an honor in working with the ARC folks and bringing these testimonies and stories out to you. I was trying to just take some notes as to, you know, what is being discussed, and each one of the story I kind of highlighted with this, you know, short sentence, and I finally ran out of page as to, you know, what more can I put in there? It seems like some abstract art that I've drawn. But, you know, when I'm kind of looking at these notes, I'm looking at issues like state violence, I'm looking at issues of ethnic cleansing, I'm looking at issues of policy, I'm looking at issues of use of language, I'm looking at detention and deportation, I'm looking at housing rights, I'm looking at labor rights, and it really reminds me, it's almost, Ban spoke about history and Ban spoke about, you know, just drawing parallels of what we have not learned, of what Dr. King once said, that, you know, the three diseases that suffer from are war, poverty, and racism. And somehow we still continue to struggle with war, poverty, and racism. As a part of another group putting this anti-war march together on September 28th, and I really call for all of you to come out there, we were doing a Cost of War watch, and there's a website that you can go on to. It's called costofwar.org. And 4 days ago, as of 5 p.m., there's been over $76 billion that has been spent on war in Iraq. And that's something very critical to understand, that while we are engaged in occupying a sovereign nation, while we are engaged in destroying cultures, there's a war that has been declared on the home front as well. And as we look at all the testimonies that we hear today, Maria Elena spoke about connecting the dots. There's one thing that weaves everything together is the use of language. Because somehow, when we are dealing with these issues, we limit our activism to what impacts us. But it's really the use of language that almost keeps us separated from all the issues that are going on. When we look at police brutality redefined as justifiable homicide, when we look at ethnic cleansing redefined as preventive detention and deportation, when we look at the language that calls upon Operation Freedom, Iraqi Freedom, which really is all about destruction and occupation, and when we look at border control, which really is killing of Mexican Americans coming across the borders, I think it's really critical that how do we challenge this language and how do we take this message home? That is something where I would want to throw a call to action out there, because we look at policies that are coming down, the Patriot Act, that how it's really relegated non-citizens to almost an administrative error now, and just, you know, somebody to deport, just pick up and pack up and get out of there. Now a new law that is being introduced, the CLEAR Act, which is going to just give local and state law enforcement authority to apprehend, detain, and deport individuals. there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and it's just wonderful, really nice to be a part of a group that's out here taking a Saturday out of their time and really mobilizing and putting their energies together. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hamid. Now I'd like to introduce to you Reverend Norman Johnson for a closing reflection. Just a little bit about Reverend Johnson. He is the executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Los Angeles. He's a native of Little Rock, Arkansas. He has been with the Christian ministry since 1973, ordained in 1979, and since 1988 has served as pastor of the First New Christian Fellowship Missionary Baptist Church in Los Angeles. He's also been pastor to two other LA churches, Galilee Baptist Church and the Greater Faith Baptist Church. Reverend Johnson has been recognized for numerous awards and participated in several important activities in L.A. involving the youth and the empowerment of the community, and someone that we, too, are proud to be able to support and fund through our work in the Hate Crime Victim Assistance Network. Reverend Norman Johnson.
The understanding of my role is that it's to be contemplative, rather, trying to bring together in some way all that we've heard, inspiring us to leave with a sense of challenge, with a sense of continuing to get out the public's truth. And so I want to share with you experience recorded in a book entitled Marginality, written by an Asian theologian, Young Lee. And he tells the story of one day taking a walk about a mile from his residence in a small park where many people often stroll along a narrow path. One beautiful autumn afternoon, I decided to stop at a pond along the path. The calm water of the pond mirrored the beautiful autumn foliage. Sitting quietly on an old stump, I observed the peaceful pond. Suddenly, a huge fish jumped up at the center of the pond, creating an enormous sound of water and powerful waves that spread in all directions. The waves moved to the edge of the pond next to where I was sitting. The beautiful concentric circles of waves lapped endlessly toward the shore. When the waves finally reached the edge, however, they began to ebb back to the center from which they had originated. Their backward movement was an amazing discovery for me, even though I should have expected it from my study of elementary physics. Perhaps I had always seen it, but not paid attention. Why did I not pay attention to ebbs returning to the center, but notice only the waves coming out of the edge? Why was I interested only in something happening at and from the center? Why did I neglect what happened at and from the margin? As I meditated on these questions of the small pond, I began to see myself as a victim of centrality. I had been taught that I should see and think from the center. That is why I had only seen waves coming from the center. After noticing the ebb recede from the edge and grow toward the center, however, I learned to see and think from the margin. Whatever came from the center would eventually return to the center because of the margin. Thinking from the margin rather than from the center gave me a fresh perspective. The challenge today is for us to think from the margin rather than the center. The interesting thing about this story is, I apply it to our situation, the big fish was always in the pond. It's that on that particular day, it jumped up and reared its head. We were told on 9/11 that a big fish had jumped up, in the sense of terrorism, Osama bin Laden, and the like. The truth of the matter is, the fish had always been in the pond. And that fish is white supremacy, and what James Lawson often calls plantation capitalism. We need to see how white supremacy marginalizes people of color every single day, and we need to see how capitalism, as it is practiced in a rather naked and terrorizing way, is marginalizing people, working people in this country every single day. We need not think from the center. The propaganda is that our government can make us safe. 3 million jobs lost, diminishing of life throughout this country. If we listen to the government, they will tell us that they can make us safe. The reality is, we are never safe as long as we believe that it is the center that gives us truth. It's the public's truth. It's the people's truth. The lived truth of those at this point in time, Middle Easterners, Muslim, immigrants, and even those of us who fought a historic struggle for decades, for centuries, to be included as citizens of this country and to be respected as human beings. Maria Elena Durazzo made the comment about Martin King and that struggle. The fact of the matter is, the civil rights struggle was not just about civil rights. It was about affirming the dignity and worth of every human being, recognizing that all of us have the divine image in us, and we should respect that irrespective of the color of our skin or the histories that brought us to this nation. If, in fact, we are to continue the public's truth, we need a fresh perspective that reminds us and helps us to see that the immigrant freedom ride and other activities that bring to surface the truth of America, the truth of what's happening in the lives of people. Unless we see that, the big fish will still be in the pond, and every now and then will jump up to remind all of the smaller fish whose pond it is. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Reverend Johnson. Just in wrapping up, I was reflecting upon what I've heard today and knowing how hard it is for people to step up forward and to relive painful experiences. And hearing their stories and hearing the similar chord through all of it, I think about the words that we so often hear these days, homeland security, national security, and I think, security for whom? I mean, here are people who cannot be secure, people who have to worry about being spit on, being fired, being attacked, being discriminated against in so many ways. And it seems to me that as we think about what that means, what those words truly mean, and make sure that they're inclusive of everyone who lives in this country, who've been part of this country, and will continue to be part of this country and this world, that those words cannot mean the policies that we are seeing in so many respects, and that we have to struggle to make sure that those words, those policies, do respect the safety and security and the dignity of all of us. We've had incredibly inspiring words, and I know it's always hard when you leave an event to keep that with you for a long time. I hope that you can. And if you want to take some action, you can do something very easily as you leave the room, and that is to sign a petition for noncompliance of the Patriot Act, which they will ask you to sign for as you walk out. And I also want to mention to you, if you want to keep it with you, you can get a video, as you might have seen, of this event for only $5. And gentlemen's left these pieces of paper there. And finally, you can keep it with you by keeping it in your heart and checking in there every once in a while to remember what you've heard today and shared with all of us. So for that, I thank all of you. I wish you have a great rest of the weekend. And may we all see each other in the future, in the struggle, coordinating, connecting the dots, as Marilena would say. Thank you.